11. Western errors. The failure of Western intelligence services to adapt their methodology to take into account the changes in communist policy and strategy in the period 1957-60 and the reintroduction of disinformation on the weakness and evolution pattern meant that those services lost their ability to produce or contribute to accurate and balanced assessments of the situation in the communist world. They unwittingly became vehicles for the further dissemination of disinformation deliberately fed to them by their communist opposite numbers. Since they failed to convey adequate warnings either about the mobilization of the bloc's intelligence potential for political action or about the techniques and patterns of disinformation, it is not surprising that Western diplomats, academics, and journalists should also have overlooked the calculated feeding of disinformation through the communications media and should increasingly have accepted at face value the disclosures made to them by communist leaders and officials in unofficial, off-the-record conversations. Acceptance of the new brand of disinformation from 1958 onward was by no means total and immediate. Until 1961 at least, there were, broadly speaking, two schools of thought among serious Western students of communist affairs. There were those who, on the basis of their long experience and acquaintanceship with communist duplicity and deceit and their intuitive mistrust of evidence and leakages emanating from communist sources, adopted a skeptical attitude toward the early manifestations of divergences and splits in the communist world and warned against the uncritical acceptance of these manifestations at their face value. Skepticism about the authenticity of Sino-Soviet differences was expressed in different ways and on different grounds by, among others, W. A. Douglas Jackson, J. Burnham, J. Lovestone, Natalie Grant, Suzanne Laban, and Tibor Mend. For example, Jackson wrote, in the latter part of 1959 and throughout 1960, as a result of different views expressed in statements issued in Peking and Moscow, the notion of a possible falling out between the two powers gained considerable momentum in some Western capitals. The desire to see a conflict develop between the CPR and the USSR is a legitimate one, but it may tend to blind the West to fundamental realities if undue weight is given to seemingly apparent signs of rift, when in fact nothing of a fundamental nature may exist. One James Burnham pointed out in the National Review that the Sino-Soviet conflict seemed to be a subject of conversation much favored by communist hosts for Western statesmen and journalists during their visits to Moscow and Peking. He wondered whether statements about the Sino-Soviet dispute were a deliberate deception by the communists or wishful thinking by non-communists, or a fusion of both. Two Suzanne Laban repeated in her book The Opinion of a Refugee from Communist China, Dr. Tang, according to whom Sino-Soviet differences stemmed from a division of labor between the USSR and China. 3. Tibor Mend, who visited China at that time, warned against exaggerating the importance of existing differences and observed that when China and the Soviet Union meet, it is not merely to bargain, but also to concert their actions. For Natalie Grant, well-versed in the history of the trust, went further, suggesting that a careful study of the material forming the alleged grounds for concluding that there is a serious Sino-Soviet conflict proves the absence of any objective foundation for such a belief. All statements regarding the existence of a serious disagreement between Moscow and Peking on foreign policy, war, peace, revolution, or attitude toward imperialism are an invention. All are the fruit of fertile imagination and unbased speculation. She also said that much of the misinformation on Sino-Soviet relations was communist-inspired and reminiscent of that almost forgotten era dominated by the Institute of Pacific Relations. The opposite school of thought applied Borkinaw's methods to the new situation and devoted great attention to the study of what came to be known as symbolic, or esoteric, evidence, which began to appear in the communist press from 1958 onward, of divergences and doctrinal disputes between different members of the communist bloc. 6. The esoteric evidence of Sino-Soviet differences was supported by various unofficial statements by Soviet and Chinese leaders, such as Khrushchev's critical remarks about the Chinese communes to the late Senator Hubert Humphrey on December 1, 1958, or Chou Enlai's frank admissions to Edgar Snow in the autumn of 1960.7 further support came from off-the-record comments by communist officials in Eastern Europe. 8. Throughout 1960 and much of 1961, opinions fluctuated between the skeptics and the believers in the esoteric evidence. Then, at the 22nd CPC Congress held in October 1961, Khrushchev delivered a public attack on the Albanian Communist Party leadership and Chou Enlai, leader of the Chinese delegation, withdrew from the Congress. The Soviet-Albanian dialogue had ceased to be esoteric and had become public. As the public polemics between the Soviet and the Albanian and Chinese leaders developed, retrospective accounts began to appear in the West of disputes that had allegedly occurred behind closed doors at the Congress of the Romanian Communist Party held in Bucharest in June 1960 and the Congress of 81 Communist Parties held in Moscow in November 1960. The most notable of these disclosures were those made in Edward Crankshaw's articles in the London Observer for February 12 and 19, 1961, and May 6 and 20, 1962. They were followed by the publication of official documents and statements in the press of the Italian, French, Belgian, Polish, and Albanian Communist Parties. This material confirmed and added to the content of the Crankshaw Articles. 9. By the end of 1962, the combination of esoteric evidence, public polemics between communist leaders, and the largely retrospective evidence of factionalism at international communist gatherings proved irresistible. Acceptance of the existence of genuine splits in the communist world became almost universal. The esoteric and the unofficial evidence from communist sources had proved themselves reliable and accurate. The continuing validity of the basic premises of the old methodology had been reconfirmed and its practitioners vindicated. The ground was cut from under the skeptics' feet. Some changed their minds. Those who retained their doubts lacked solid evidence with which to back them and had no option but to keep silent. Study of the splits built up its own momentum, creating on the way a variety of personal commitments to and vested interests in the validity of an analysis that demonstrated the accelerating disintegration of the communist monolith. New students entering the field had no incentive and no basis for challenging the accepted orthodoxy or for re-examining the basic premises of the methodology or the validity of the evidence on which they were founded. The development of splits in the communist world appeals to Western consciousness in many ways. It feeds the craving for sensationalism, it raises hopes of commercial profit, it stirs memories of past heresies and splits in the communist movement. It shows that factionalism is an element in communist as in Western politics. It supports the comforting illusion that, left to itself, the communist world will disintegrate and that the communist threat to the rest of the world will vanish. And it confirms the opinions of those who, on intellectual grounds, reject the pretensions of communist dogma to provide a unique, universal, and infallible guide to the understanding of history and the conduct of policy. Not surprisingly, therefore, evidence in official communist sources that conflicts with the image of disunity and disarray in the communist world and that points, or can be interpreted as pointing, to continuing cooperation between the Soviet Union, China, Romania, and Yugoslavia and continuing coordination in the implementation of the long-range bloc policy has been discounted or ignored. The focus of attention is almost invariably on the evidence of discord. So exciting has this evidence been, and so lacking has been Western understanding of the motives and techniques of communist disinformation that less and less attention has been paid to the communist origin of the evidence. Virtually all of it has in fact been provided to the West by communist governments and parties through their press and intelligence services. Failing to take this into account, Western observers have fallen deeper and deeper into the trap that was set for them. The present situation is reminiscent of the NEP period with one important difference. In the 1920s, Western mistakes related only to Soviet Russia. Now the mistakes relate to the whole communist world. Where the West should see unity and strategic coordination in the communist world, it sees only diversity and disintegration. Where it should see the revival of ideology, the stabilization of communist regimes, and the reinforcement of party control, it sees the death of ideology and evolution toward or convergence with the democratic system. Where it should see new communist maneuvers, it sees moderation in communist policy. Communist willingness to sign agreements with the West for tactical reasons on a deceptive basis is misinterpreted as the reassertion of great power national interests over the pursuit of long-range ideological goals. Two further tendencies have helped to compound the series of Western errors. The tendency to apply clichés and stereotypes derived from the study of conventional national regimes to the study of communist countries, overlooking or underestimating the ideological factor in their internal systems and their relations with one another, and the tendency toward wishful thinking. Both tendencies favor the uncritical acceptance by the West of what communist sources, official and unofficial, say in particular about the Sino-Soviet dispute. Much of the Western literature on the subject lumps together historical evidence on rivalry between the two countries when they were governed by czars and emperors, with the controversies between them in the 1920s through the 1960s. All this in an effort to substantiate the authenticity of the current dispute without any serious attempt to study the different factors in operation in different periods. The focus of Western attention is always on the split and not on the evidence from the same communist sources, scanty though it is, of continuing Sino-Soviet collaboration. Western analysts, inside and outside government, seem to be more concerned with speculation on future relations between the communist and non-communist worlds than with critical examination of the evidence on which their interpretation of events is based. Nationalism was an important force in communist parties during Stalin's last years and the crisis after his death. Various parties were affected by it, particularly those in Yugoslavia, Poland, Hungary, and Georgia. It is important to realize, however, that nationalist dissent in the parties at that time was a reaction to Stalin's departures from Leninist principles of internationalism. Once Stalin's practices had been condemned and the necessary readjustments had been made from 1956 to 57 onward in the conduct of communist affairs, particularly with regard to relations between the CPSU and other communist parties, the basis for nationalist dissent in those other parties progressively disappeared. From then on, nationalist feelings in the respective populations were a factor that the communist regimes could deal with by an agreed diversity of tactics and by the calculated projection of a false image of the national independence of communist parties. Whatever the appearances, since 1957 to 60, the regimes in China, Romania, Yugoslavia, and Dubček's Czechoslovakia have not been motivated by different brands of national communism. Their actions have been consistently dictated by Leninist ideology and tactics directed toward the pursuit of the long-range interests and goals of the communist bloc as a whole, to which the national interests of the peoples of the communist world are subordinated. The fundamental Western error throughout has been to overlook the adoption of the long-range bloc policy and the role and pattern of communist disinformation. Either disinformation is not taken into account at all, or it is assumed that a facade and strength pattern is being followed. In reality, the weakness and evolution pattern has applied since 1958 to 60. Disinformation on this pattern has laid the basis for erroneous Western assessments of the communist world, which in turn have engendered mistakes in Western responses and policies. As a result, the communist world has been allowed systematically to implement its long-range policy over a period of more than 20 years.